This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded June 13, 2013. We are still at NDC and now we're talking to John McCoy. And you just finished two back-to-back sessions on .NET security, right?
Yep, sure did.
So what were those sessions about?
I started off the first session about my trials and tribulations of coming into the security arena from .NET. That when I first got into it, security was basically non-existent in .NET, and it was basically a black sheep of the security community. No one wanted it, no one needed it, and that was 5-6 years ago. So,
did people think they didn't need it because they just felt like they were probably secure enough?
Most of the tools, like IDA Pro or the old tools that people relied on for reverse engineering and attacking, just didn't quite apply to .NET. It didn't have buffer overflows. It was still pretty new. And it was still growing. It was one virus in the lab that was a proof of concept. There was no real malware on the streets. That it was, from a assembly coder's perspective, it was really, really hard.
Huh. So in your two talks, what do you talk about? Like, you kind of, I'm assuming you scare people a bit, right?
I try not to. These talks, I try to convey how I got into security, how I view it, what the realm of .NET is in the security perspective. And beyond that, I found amazing code that you can do that is completely impossible.
That word impossible, I don't think it means what you think.
And I cover that I misuse words on.
Okay, so what's an example of some kind of mind-blowing things that you can do that people wouldn't expect?
The day-to-day stuff, I would say the easiest to wrap your head around is if you find a jar, like you Google and you find a really nice Java project that does nodal graph databases, and you want to use that, but there's no .NET equivalent, you can take that jar, convert it into a .NET, and have basically 100% code conversion that works out of the box, enterprise-ready, can be used on a daily basis, and then you can forget that it was ever a jar. Like, you have to do a little bit of wrapping to get it into, like, the .NET paradigm, but then you're good to go. And I've worked on a number of enterprise applications that included jars, and it set us above the competition by far.
Wow. And I guess that's a nice side effect of the security side of it, lets you know more what you can do under the hood then, right?
Yeah, once you're, I've spent years down in the runtime to where like coding in IL started becoming native. And I remember when I first saw it, I'm like, oh, this is awful. And now it's like, I love the dupe command. And I'm actually starting to get underneath the runtime. Like, I'm to the point where I understand, like, how the JIT works, how to manipulate the JIT, and how to affect the output remap functions post-JITting. And like, in my talks, I did one talk on coding, and I just showed people how you take assembly code, and you can work with an assembly coder on your team and map them in managed functions, not unsafe, pure code, keep it stable. You can use C++ to talk to .NET objects, high-level objects, and you can use assembly code to talk to .NET objects. And so I showed calling a message box from assembly code. Mm-hmm. And so like maybe you're writing a video game and that assembly code function is so much faster, but you're in .NET, now you can. Now you can take assembly code, map it into a .NET function, call it, and you're stable.
Wow, okay.
And it sounds like the one talk, you showed some tools for hacking with .NET. What were some of those tools?
I make a memory injection platform that gets you inside, which is really like 20 lines of code. Like, there's no magic to any of this. And then I show how to inject into another application, take over its forms, remap the GUIs, remap the object layout of another application running live, stably. Like, I handle threading, I handle all the high-level objects. There's no magic to it. And I also make, it's not a decompiler, it's an editor. So normal decompilers round trip through source code. I just put you in there and I straight edit IL code. And so if you want to go in and you want to flip a Boolean, you want to flip a variable to a different variable, you want to flip an if statement, 6 clicks. And like I showed how you can rewire the biometric software on my machine to show you my admin password, to allow you to add your fingerprint into my computer.
Oh.
And it's 6 clicks. Six.
Wow.
Like, and there's the security, I deal with helping people secure themselves, and so I learned how to hack incredibly well, and everything that I'm showing is all held back for a minimum of 2 years. Like, everything that I'm showing, I've been using this in the wild and defending my clients with this.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then, Yeah, I guess there's the two sides to it, right? And so you can play both sides of the game. You find out the vulnerability, and then you find out how to protect against that.
Yeah, I tried to carry across the metaphor that it's kind of like being bitten by a radioactive bug and getting superpowers. That it's like, other people make code, I can fight in code. And, like, you definitely want me fighting on your side in code.
Right, right. So the naive approach is, well, I make an assembly and I obfuscate it. I run it through some, you know, standard obfuscator, and aren't I pretty safe, though?
You are. And the problem with obfuscators and packers and all of these types of protection is they're pretty much anything you can do programmatically, you can undo programmatically. If you can use this type of logic obfuscation, you can go through and remap that. And I would say it's closest to sitting down on a project that was written by a team of interns and being tasked with cleaning it up. Of course you can. And the de-obfuscators just do it specific for each obfuscator. And I would say you have a 3-month lag on most obfuscators that have any popularity between them coming out and an off-the-shelf free hacker tool to break it.
Is that just the way it will always be, or is there something like the .NET runtime or IL itself could do to make it harder to, you know, like?
This stuff has been around since C++ and all the way back, and I know what messes me up. I know what footprints other people leave, and I can track those footprints, and I can do bad things to people who are using these techniques. And it's all a game of cat and mouse. Like, you can never win, but the best thing I would say is have a layered defense and detect early. I really tried to drive home that you can do security unit tests. If you do SQL cleaning, force SQL cleaning on the entire application, website, whatever. And if you have an intern coming on and he doesn't do SQL cleaning, it lets you know. Noting the difference between an exception and a security exception. If I try to log onto your website and access your database after logging in, that's one thing. If I bypass your authentication and I just force myself onto your website, and then I try and talk to your database and I get an exception, that's a security exception. And you can, knowing that someone is attacking you is, because if someone has 2 years to attack you without you knowing it, they're going to win.
Right.
If you can see them attacking you, and maybe you just go and yank the internet plug, and it's like, well, they're attacking us, we're going dark.
Yeah, which big picture is so much better, right? I mean, like, if LinkedIn had a 2-day outage, that would be a bummer. But if they have all their passwords stolen, that's a bigger bummer.
And when you're talking about desktop applications, you're talking about you made a mistake on your update mechanism, and now I can push malware to all of your users. I can go to enterprises that are using your software and take over entire enterprises. And that's
the bigger thing that I've, you know, heard more and more of. Like, it used to be malware was about, it was just annoying. But now it's really targeted, right? And people are going out, and it's malware that you don't even know is installed, and it's inside your company or it's inside your website or whatever, doing who knows what. But it's not just screwing around. It's got a targeted purpose, right?
Oh, yeah. And .NET is adaptive to the platform it's distributed on. And as it's adaptive, its footprint changes, and so AV has a hard time with an adaptive footprint. Mm. So, I mean, almost by the nature of .NET, it's polymorphic. Mm. And so AV's like, oh.
Yeah.
And then you, like, there's a really bad flaw in Visual Studios that Microsoft will not fix. It's been known since 2004. When you open a form and it has a control on there, the control is rendered on the form. Its constructor is actually fired. Arbitrary code from that GUI loads without you running it. So by you looking at it, it runs. And so I can go put a demo project up on CodePlex. You open it up, you look at it, you don't run it, and it runs arbitrary code inside the Visual Studios memory space. All of the rights of Visual Studios, SVN access, database access, all of your keys access, and the memory footprint is so huge.
And a lot of people run Visual Studios Administrator for different purposes too, right? So that's,
And you do get the dialog box about you're going to open a project from an untrusted source, which most people just say, yes, I want this to open up.
I downloaded it off of CodePlex and changed my mind.
I mean, you personally, is that something where you take a step back and say, whoa, I'm not clicking this button until I do some digging in this?
I actually work down under the runtime. I've left the normal tracks that I can't even remember last time I Googled for something. Typically, I recommend, that was something I really went into detail on that I thought was important, is that what I think a good developer box should consist of is full disk crypto. So if you lose your laptop at the coffee shop, your database doesn't go with your
SVN. Is BitLocker sufficient?
No. TrueCrypt, BitLocker has known backdoors. TrueCrypt has unknown backdoors. Well, I mean, BitLocker is sufficient, but I would suggest against it. Buying a YubiKey and using really long random passwords. If you want to add a couple of characters with it, that's cool. But when you buy a YubiKey, buy a couple of them and keep backups. So you have to put in your YubiKey, click it, 30-character password, no one is breaking. If you lose it in the coffee shop, your keys in your wallet, you can say 100% none of the company data was lost. Doing VMs. Keep those VMs in sub-TrueCrypt volumes and unlock a volume with your database credentials, your database, all of your client information in there. Unlock that with another YubiKey. And so when you hand your computer to your niece and she goes to Facebook and gets malware, that container is still secure.
You're saying YubiKey?
YubiKey. Y-U-B-I-K-E-Y. YubiKey from Yubico.
Okay.
It's a Swedish company. It's about 20 US dollars individually or so, give or take. And they're tiny little USB keyboards, and they fake a USB key.
Oh.
And it'll just type in a long random password. It will also do one-time validation, but then that doesn't really apply to TrueCrypt or full disk encryption.
Okay.
And they're beautiful. I don't think they're the answer, but they are on the right evolutionary chain.
What do you think about things like KeePass or LastPass or things like password managers?
I think they are an inherent weakness that will destroy everything if everyone uses it. I think there's no way to avoid it. I commonly deal with clients that have 200 passwords, identities, sites that they access, and that's just unreasonable.
Yeah.
So I think they're a necessary evil. I don't know how we're going to resolve it.
You don't think things like OpenID, OpenOffice, worthwhile at all?
Anything that has centralized authentication makes me nervous. I mean, if OpenID got compromised, now I compromise Google.
Yeah.
There is no good solution. I think they're absolutely essential. I think using KeePass or LastPass is critical.
Did you ever, I was a fan of CardSpace and whatever, InfoCard, didn't catch on, but that seemed like at least it takes, and it abstracts things to a level where, website or whatever, mess around. Did that seem like a good approach to you? Or?
Yeah, the fundamental idea of I have my crypto key and I somehow not only authenticate, but actually interact. I have to unlock the data to interact with it. And that had such potential, and I was definitely rooting for that. But at this point, make the best of it. If you do use KeePass, one of my favorite things you can do is you can locate the KeePass in a protected cloud vault. And so you basically achieve all of the cloud storage of LastPass with the local retention. You don't trust them.
Yeah.
But I recommend it. I like both of them. I've read through KeePass, and I was fairly happy with what I saw.
Earlier you were talking about circumventing or getting into to IL or, an assembly. Does signed code help much with that, or any?
Unfortunately, signed code isn't validated, so it only checks that the key is valid. It does not check that the code hasn't been modified, because you would have such a long load time for hashing all of the DLLs.
Right.
So, And then if you do sign code, do you validate that it's your key and not some hacker's key? And it's like, there's so much infrastructure that the ROI is basically zero.
Interesting.
I mean, you might as well. It's good in the sense that I can sign it, and then you can post facto look at the cache and say, this has definitely tampered. But it in no way actually helps you. It helps with like a forensics investigation or something.
Do you get involved with those, like forensics or things like that?
I try not to. I was trained in it. I was brought up in forensics as my intro to security. And I still really love it. Like, I love working with massive data streams. And that's what forensics is. And from time to time. But my main thing is helping small businesses get secure, helping products get secure, deal with attacks.
It seems like, though, most of the time, small businesses don't care about security until there's a problem, right?
Then they really care.
And so you're being brought in as a problem. And so what's your general approach? It's just plain detective, right? To figure out what's going on? Or?
I kind of see my approach is kind of a security fitness coach. Like, I come in and help them evaluate why they're being attacked and who's attacking. And what do they care about? What's their priorities? And now let's kind of work out a plan from here you are. Here's what steps you can do right away. And here's the long-term goals and how we get you there.
Okay.
With so many applications now running on mobile devices, is there a different security story there if you've been looking at vulnerabilities on different devices and different runtimes?
Yeah. It's actually kind of everyone said, well, now we're all about cloud security, and now cloud security has come back to the client. And so it's kind of a little ironic. Desktop developers don't secure their code against SQL injection. Web developers do. And then web developers working on mobile apps don't secure against password retention inside of the app. And it's kind of this cross-functional skill. And that's part of what I help companies with of, okay, you're a desktop app, I know this, but you still have to SQL clean. They can still wipe your database or do bad things to you. So I would say, and with .NET being cross-platform, it's the same game on a new platform. Yeah, it all trends. That's what I love about .NET.
What do you think about two-factor auth? Does that help enough?
Yeah. I think three-factor auth is never going to take, because whatever that third factor is, it's really hard to change, like your fingerprints.
Right.
So you join company A and company B, and they both have your fingerprints.
Oh.
And I think the answer lies somewhere around two-factor, crypto blobs, maybe cloud crypto blobs. We're working on some internal applications to try and deal with this for our internal clients. But
I'll confess stupidity. I don't know what you mean, but when you say crowd crypto blobs, it sounds really cool, but I don't know what you mean.
Well, like, you have your key pass.
Oh, okay.
And you have to store that, but then let's unlock crowd crypto blob with a YubiKey, then that grants you access to KeyPass, and then let's authenticate into that with a one-time token also out of the YubiKey or maybe something else, and now, So pretty much what LastPass gives you, except for they could do bad things to you if they wanted. So what kind of separates me from a typical security person is that I come from a developer standpoint. Typically, security is done from an IT.
Right.
And it's that actually showing a developer, this is what you should have coded. This is, like just recently, AES as a transport protocol was broken. And so AES is fine for full disk crypto, but if you use it as a transport, they can pull your key right out of your stream. It turns out the jitter between the packets divulges your key.
Uh-huh.
And just showing them, like, when you do crypto, you need to do this because of this. This is why this is important. And a lot of the time, it's actually for small businesses that are under attack, continuously being attacked. It's literally trying to deal with that problem. Like, how do you deal with someone that keeps putting out cracks? How do you deal with someone that keeps attacking your clients with malware? And actually building defenses on code level. And I'm still a coder at heart. I just happen to be in security.
So there's the attack side of it, but there's also just like the crack side of it, right? People want to, like, if you're selling a product and then you want to require a license key and then people crack it and all that, do you get involved with trying to prevent that? You know,
sure. It typically doesn't stop. Typically, I get called in for someone that keeps getting cracks, keeps getting malware. Even someone that takes your program and decompiles it and puts a new face on it and sells it.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about cracks and malware is the intention, sure, sometimes someone is getting paid to make a crack, and then people use your program for free. Often, it's even more sinister or more benign than that, where someone just wants access to 10,000 machines as a proxy network. Someone wants 10,000 machines to do password cracking. Or I've even seen cloud storage, where someone just started taking over machines, putting out cracks just because they wanted cloud storage on everyone's machine. And and when it comes down to it, most applications, I would say, maybe half an hour to put out a crack. So the ROI is extremely high.
Like, yeah.
And even if you just take over machines and sell them for $1 a machine for an hour, then you have 1 million machines, you can make $1 million an hour. And also, it's become really weird big business where you can infect millions of machines, and then there's some chance that you're inside of Pepsi.
Right.
And you can just sell
it. Or Valve, right? There's the famous Valve thing.
Yeah.
Right?
And you can sell that machine for $100 million, $500,000, $1,000. And so there's a lot of weird business models. And that's part of, like, dealing with a problem on a business is, what are they doing? Why are they doing it? How do we convince them that the ROI isn't there? How do we slow them down? And
I see, for instance, I get a lot of, you know, bad spam sent to my Microsoft email address with PDFs attached, right? And I know not to open the random spam. But, I mean, it's like you send it to thousands of people. One of them opens up. And the common one I keep hearing is you send something to a company and it's written about that company. And it's like, this is an invoice and blah, blah, blah. Can you take a look at it? And a lot of people will open that up, you know?
Yeah. And that's why I kind of talk about doing virtual machines. Like, you do a really hardened machine that you're going to cruise the internet on.
Mm.
And then maybe there's another machine that talks to your... Maybe you set up a whole new email account that has admin over your bank account. And you look at that on your hardened machine. And so no matter what someone sends you to that bank account email, you probably will never click anything.
Yeah.
And it's nice because everyone knows this is my admin account. I never give this out to anyone. So if someone says, hey, I met you, let's be friends on Facebook, click this link, they're like, I absolutely know.
Right, right.
Yeah. I recommend separating email addresses, admin and normal.
So you mentioned some tools earlier. Can you tell us about those?
Yeah. We make Grey Wolf, which is an editor for .NET executables and DLL. So you can go in and make a private, a public. You can edit the flow of an application. And Grey Dragon that injects you in. And we have a lot of demos, so you can see how a key gen looks, how a key cracker looks. And you can kind of get a feel for the light .NET programming security space. All free, papers, white papers, all up there at digitalbodyguard.com.
Yeah, I've been there before. I've looked at it. You mentioned a little bit earlier about disclosure, like that you publish those, but you don't do that for a certain amount of time, right? There's procedures for doing this kind of stuff?
It's an internally decided one.
Okay.
It's pretty much just for economic reasons that I can come up with a technique that will not be known by basically anyone else that I found that I can use to defend my clients, and I can almost guarantee that the hackers won't know about this technique. And so I can use this technique for a couple of years, and every client I give them a unique protection, a unique defense, a unique attack. Like, for the last couple of years, I only recently started disclosing it, that you pack in that Visual Studio's exploit that runs code when they look at it. You pack that into your deployable. When they reverse engineer you, it pings home and says, hey, I've been reverse engineered. Here's the IP address.
Oh,
here's me.
Yeah.
And I was using that for a long time. After a while, I'm like, okay, other people have probably caught on to what I'm doing. I'll put this out there publicly.
Yeah.
And yeah, I stay ahead of the curve.
How do you keep up with everything? I mean, there's probably both, like, you follow what other people are doing, and you're also just digging around into the code yourself.
It's really lonely in the .NET security space.
Huh.
There was 4 .NET security people that were in it, and one went off to Java and mobile. Another was on, I think, like, Iron Ruby, and then that died and quit .NET. And, like, the number of .NET security people, like, who wants to live in the runtime? Like,
yeah.
And I've been on .NET since 1.1. Like, I live in it. Like, most security people aren't coders, and the ones that do, don't. It's undocumented. It's where dragons live.
You know, it's interesting, too, you mentioned before, but, like, as a .NET developer, you think of, like, this magical, I'm writing on the .NET runtime, right? But it's really, like, you've got MSIL, and then the core of, like, you know, Windows or whatever operating system, it's all under the hood. It's, like, the Win32 API or whatever, and you've got, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You've got COM objects down there. And
it's like the Matrix. Like, all of these things we think are real, like, code access security, and it's like, yeah, but, like, if you reach around it, yeah, I definitely make parallels of, there's some rules that you can bend and some rules that you can break. And basically anything can be broken. And that's why I like coding in assembly code in .NET. Because when you go to assembly code in .NET, anything is possible.
Do you have anything you'd recommend for developers that are interested in learning more about this?
I have done a lot of talks, and I cover a fair amount there, and I have it up on my website. I have some really good papers. The ones I'd recommend is Attacking .NET at Runtime and Reflections Hidden Power, and those are, like, they'll be like, oh, you can modify anyone's memory space. There's nothing stopping you. You can modify any variable in any process, and Reflections Hidden Power of just, you can, there is no public, there is no private, just, it's all open. All executables are the same. Like, if I wrote a DLL and you wrote a DLL, we can both use them the same. There's no separation. There's no reason we can't. And so I can use my biometrics DLL just as easily as I can use my own. Like, yeah.
Wow. Well, all right. I think that's a good place to wrap up. So thanks a lot for your time. This is fascinating.
Cool. Thank you.